people are never going to understand how critical this particular time in history is. We have $7.7 trillion worth of economic events that are going to hit America in the gut.
This is An Economy of One with Gary Rathbun, President and CEO of Private Wealth Consultants, the free market voice, of the U.S., enhancing and protecting private wealth. Gary Rathbun has over 30 years of experience in making the best choices for you to keep more of what you earn. It's life, liberty, and the pursuit of self-reliance. An Economy of One with Gary Rathbun. This is
greetings and welcome again to An Economy of One. I am your host, Gary Rathbun. I truly hope all of you had a great Christmas. I know I did. I love this time of year. The only time of year I get a little bit sentimental and reflect back and think about things. But last Wednesday on my regional show in Northern Ohio, I had a little fun. And I don't know if you remember this or not, but there was a Seinfeld episode years ago about Festivus. Festivus, a holiday for, that's right, the rest of us. And it was a made-up holiday from the character George Costanza's father and that kind of stuff. But the first part of Festivus was the airing of grievances. And so Wednesday on the show, I aired some grievances, and I got to tell you, I'm not a big Christmas shopper. I have very little family left. It's mainly just me and my wife on my side. She has a sister, and they come over and that kind of stuff. But anyway, we went out and did a little bit of shopping. Everybody loves Uncle Gary because I shop at the bank and give out little envelopes. So that's easy. We talked about that last time. But we did go out and try to pick up a few gifts for everybody. And one of the things that just bothered me, and this is one of my grievances that I aired for Festivus last week, was find something not made in China. It just aggravated me to no end. I can't tell you how much stuff I picked up and put back because it was made in China. Now, for those of you that listen to me a long time, you know that I'm not a made-in-America guy because I'm pro-union and that kind of stuff. I'm a made-in-America kind of guy because I think we make the best stuff. And we do the best job making stuff. You know, I picked up a bag of dog treats for my dogs. Not for Christmas, just dog treats. And my wife said, where are they made? And I looked at it. You know what? It's distributed by a company in New Jersey, made in China. Do we really need to make dog treats in China? Are we saving that much money on a $5 item for our dogs? I mean, I didn't buy them. I don't trust the stuff coming out of China to even feed to my dogs, let alone to eat myself or feed the family. I mean, my goodness, everything you pick up, made in China. That's my grievance. Why can't we make it here? Now, in all fairness, quite a few jobs are being repatriated. Companies are bringing jobs back, but only because China is raising their wages. It makes it less effective. Now, I was born in the 50s. And as I've said many times, I'm not as old as I sound, but I remember the 60s. And I remember nobody wanted the crap coming out of Japan. Remember that? He didn't want anything made in Japan. Made in Japan signified that it was cheap and that we want American stuff. Well, we've just swapped out Japan for China recently. And everything is made in China. Now, I've had experience with manufacturing in China, and it's subpar. Had to have it redone again here. It was just prototypes, but the prototypes, subpar. And quite honestly, I'm just sick of the crap. Now, one factor that goes into that, we saw recently this week, was what they call inversions. Inversion is where an American company will merge with or buy another company whose jurisdiction is in a country with a more favorable tax basis to the business. And President Obama and Treasury Secretary Jack Lew have been trying to go around Congress and write laws, invoke rules, trying to prevent inversions. Now, when I say going around Congress, I don't mean that they're going against Congress's wishes. I think Congress wants to prevent inversions also. But I think there's too many lobbying dollars there, and Congress tends to make things more complex than what they are. But everybody's going about it the wrong way. You can't, well, you got to look at why companies want to leave this country. And they want to leave this country because of the high tax rates on foreign profits. So we have that one of the highest tax rate, corporate tax rates in the world. So for these companies to make money outside the country and bring the money back, very expensive. If they pay dividends, they're double taxed. That's after-tax money to the corporation, taxable income to you, the stockholder receiving the dividend. Well, that's very expensive to do that. And I think Mr. Liu, I think President Obama, I think Congress needs to step back and think, well, why not make the United States the best choice for business locations? Why not have other countries moving their headquarters here because of regulatory and tax favorability, rather than penalizing our countries, trying to make them out to be bad, evil corporations that don't want to pay their fair share, when Congress and the White House are trying to confiscate more than a fair share in taxes? You penalize a behavior, you get less of it. You reward a behavior, you get more of it. This is the Laffer curve. Less taxes on corporations will mean more revenue to the government, and it'll mean more jobs and more companies staying here, new companies coming here. Now, what happened was there was a fertilizer maker called CF Industries out of Illinois that was merging with a company in Great Britain. So Jack Lew, Treasury Secretary, tried to force a rule saying that nobody could merge with companies in the United Kingdom and move their headquarters there. So what did CF Industries do? CF Industries did what corporations do. They said, okay, we're going to go ahead with the merger, but instead of being located in Great Britain, we're going to locate in the Netherlands now. Tax base is the same as Great Britain. They're going to get the same benefit. And not only did we get screwed, Illinois got screwed out of some jobs, but now Great Britain got screwed out of some jobs, unbeknownst to them. It was just our law. So we need to change that. We need to get back to making the United States the favorable place to do business. We need to bring those jobs back, and the only way we can do that is to have a higher incentive for companies to bring it back here than to be elsewhere. And I got to tell you, I know it's just not cheap labor. Cheap labor is part of it, but when you're making crap, it doesn't matter how cheap the labor is, it's still crap. So having that made in America will be better for all of us, more so from a quality standpoint than just a cheap labor standpoint. Joining me next is Dan Mitchell. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. He specializes in fiscal policy, particularly tax reform, international tax competition, and the economic burden of government spending. We'll talk to him next.
An Economy of One with Gary Rathbun. back to An Economy of One with Gary Rathbun.
Joining me now is Daniel Mitchell. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, specializing in fiscal policy, particularly tax reform, international tax competition, and the economic burden of government spending. Dan's work has been published in numerous outlets, including Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Forbes, USA Today, and Investors Business Daily. His blog is International Liberty and can be found at danieljmitchell.wordpress.com. A lot's been happening in Washington lately. Everything from the Federal Reserve raising interest rates to the recent spending bill. And I wanted to chat with you a little bit. What do you think of this spending bill that's going through the process right now?
It's not good news for taxpayers. There's a lot of pork barrel spending, a lot of wasteful programs that should be eliminated but are getting more money. The really bad news actually happened back in October. That's when they agreed to bust the spending caps. Mm. This spending bill that they're doing right now is simply the follow-up to that. They already agreed we're going to spend more money, and this is the actual spending of the more money. And as you probably know, they also have a special interest tax bill, the so-called extenders bill. So instead of cleaning up all the corruption and nonsense in our 75,000-page tax code, they're making it more complex. It's not the end of the world. It's not as if we're doing more than just adding another straw to the camel's back. But sooner or later, we're going to wind up being Greece.
Yeah, and it's kind of disappointing because some of the conservatives had pretty high hopes for the new speaker, and already people feel a little let down by him.
It is rather amazing that when Republicans only controlled the House and Democrats controlled the Senate and the White House, they were getting better results than they're getting right now when they control the Senate and the House. So I don't know what's going on. I don't know whether it's McConnell's fault, Ryan's fault. I suspect, since I talk to a lot of these people on Capitol Hill, they're just so afraid that there's going to be a government shutdown and Obama's going to go, boo, it's your fault.
Right.
And even though they've won previous shutdowns, I mean, that's why we actually made some progress for a few years there with a de facto spending freeze. But Republicans, their political consultants tell them, oh, no, if you do a shutdown, people will think you can't govern. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to govern a Leviathan. I want to shrink Leviathan.
Right. You know, I was reading one of your columns, and you make a great comment about the term bipartisan. And that agreement between the evil party and the stupid party is not very comforting. Now, I'm not sure which party has which label, and it's probably interchangeable. But do you think we need a little more partisanship now rather than bipartisanship?
Well, if bipartisanship simply means that both parties conspire to rip off the American people and keep America on a path of becoming Greece, then no, I don't want bipartisanship. I don't want the established elite in Washington from both parties agreeing to figure out how to extract more money from me and to keep us on the wrong path. So, yes, I want some fighting. I want a government shutdown if it means that we actually maybe at least slow down our drift in the wrong direction.
You know, in one of your other columns, you quote Kevin Williamson from the National Review about these politicians like the Clintons and President Obama and several others wanting to build a patronage society. What's a patronage society in relation to this?
Well, the short answer is it's Greece. Okay. But to elaborate, what it means is a patronage society means that you have interest groups and politicians engaging in back-scratching, washing each other's hands, but basically they extract money from taxpayers and divvy it up among themselves. They reward themselves. They give themselves insider deals, insider contracts. They get rich, and we get poor. And what happens over time is as more and more people figure out how they can ride in the wagon and fewer people wind up pulling the wagon, that's when you get a societal breakdown like you have in Greece.
You know, I heard on the radio, and I forget who said it the other day, that Americans have become essentially a commodity for government, and we've outlived our usefulness pretty much. And you know, when you talk about DMV, IRS, post office, all these types of workers for the government, they couldn't get anywhere near that kind of money in the public sector. And you make the great point that it's not the people receiving the welfare checks, it's the people who write them and all the administration behind it. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, my friend Walter Williams, the great George Mason University economist, calls the bureaucracy poverty pimps, because they're the ones that really profit from the whole welfare state. They're the ones that get these lavish six-figure salaries, these enormous bloated government pensions. And again, this is exactly what we saw in Greece, where you wound up having a society where more and more and more people were riding in the wagon, either as the welfare recipients or the welfare distributors. It just becomes too much at some point. And I used the analogy earlier about the straw that breaks the camel's back. Well, we keep adding straws on. Now, we're hopefully 15, 20, 25 years away from being Greece, but what worries me is we keep sliding slowly but surely in that direction.
You know, and I'm with you, it's very disturbing to me because it seems like the American people are somewhat smarter or better informed than they have been in the past. And you would think that, you know, large groups, the population, should have the power when in government like ours, you say that it's the small groups that have the power, because the benefit of being in the large group is so small that there's really no motivation to do anything to fight the small groups.
Yeah, this is what public finance economists call the concentrated benefits dispersed cost phenomenon. Now, that's a lot of academic jargon. It doesn't really matter. But think about it. We only have a couple of thousand sugar farmers in the United States, beet growers, cane growers, stuff like that. But they are very well organized. They give hundreds of thousands of dollars to the politicians, and they've gotten in place these sugar subsidies and tariffs and other favoritism where they get literally millions of dollars of benefits, and American consumers pay much, much higher prices than the world average. So you and I as consumers, we don't really understand why sugar is expensive. We might not even know it's expensive compared to the rest of the world. So 99% of us in America are hurt by the sugar program, but the tiny share of the population that benefits, they're very well organized, and they give lots of money to the politicians. And that's an example of how the system works for the interest groups, not for the American people.
Coming up, we'll continue our discussion with Dan Mitchell, the senior fellow at the Cato Institute.
Gary Rathbun, An Economy of One. To An Economy of One with Gary Rathbun.
I'm speaking with Daniel Mitchell. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, specializing in fiscal policy, particularly tax reform, international tax competition, and the economic burden of government spending. You know, I've said for a long time that it seems like there's too many large corporations in this country that are more in the business of getting money from the government than they are in producing a product or service competitively and making a profit. I know it's been going on for a long time, but is there any light at the end of the tunnel on this crony capitalism, this harvesting the product of government money?
Well, there is a light at the end of the tunnel, but it's a train that's
it's coming at us at 90, right?
We've probably always had some cronyism and corruption with big companies figuring out how to work the political system, even going back to the nation's founding. But it's just like the welfare state. If every single year more and more people get trapped in government dependency, and every single year more and more companies figure out, hey, it's better to just rely on government contracts than actually produce things that consumers want. That is a very bad recipe. That is exactly the recipe that caused Greece to become a failed state. And so, yes, I get frustrated because I feel like, you know, working in Washington, I feel like I have a front row seat to a slow motion tragedy.
That's incredible. It's fascinating reading all of your columns and watching your videos and stuff. One of the big things that we talked about on the show that I haven't seen much press on, and that's the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Have you done much looking at that and analysis of what that's going to do to us?
No, we have a whole team of trade people at Cato who are looking at that. And so I haven't had any particular reason to look at it closely. I will tell you that we love free trade, of course.
Sure.
Politicians and bureaucrats shouldn't be able to hold guns to our head and prevent us from trading with each other. The problem is sometimes you get these agreements where politicians from country A and politicians from country B come together, and at best they give us managed trade, and maybe, you know, on net it's moving in the right direction, but it's very, very frustrating because the best approach is just to be like Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
There's free trade. Not trade where the politicians are giving permission, not trade where the politicians are putting in all sorts of environmental and labor union mandates and things like that. I confess I don't know the details about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but I know it's very frustrating to our free trade people at Cato why we don't just follow the very successful model of Hong Kong, and instead we have this system that at least as a side effect, winds up empowering lots of bureaucrats and politicians.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you reference Hong Kong because, you know, they're essentially owned by Beijing, which is kind of the polar opposite of Hong Kong. And you've referenced Greece quite a few times. And for the last, I don't know, maybe 10, 12 months, Greece hasn't really been in the news too much. Before, it was headline every day. Obviously, they're probably not much better off than they were a year ago. What do we need to do? What does this country need to do to not end up being Greece 10, 15 years from now?
We basically need to reform our entitlements. That's the giant long-run problem. No ifs, ands, and buts about it. But we also should be shutting down things like the Department of Education, the Department mm-hmm. of Energy, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. It's not just the entitlement programs. It's the so-called discretionary spending programs as well. But here's the simple thing. In the long run, if government grows faster than the private sector, sooner or later will collapse. So mm-hmm. obviously the solution is to make sure government grows slower than the private sector. In other words, if we can have 4% growth and we can somehow limit government so it only grows 2% a year, in the long run, those trend lines will be very, very positive. And that's why some sort of spending limit rule, and I've been publicizing this thing called the Swiss debt brake on my blog because that's a spending cap that has worked very, very well in Switzerland. It basically says government can grow 2% a year, and normally, even in a relatively weak economy, your nominal GDP is going to grow by more than 2% a year. So mm-hmm. we know what the answer is. We even have real-world examples of what works. The problem is our political system is so dysfunctional with Republicans and Democrats engaging in this bipartisan orgy of waste.
Absolutely incredible. You know, we've spoken to Véronique de Rougie over to the Mercatus Center quite often about the Export-Import Bank. And we both predicted several months ago that they were going to revive it. It expired in June or something. And it looks like they have put that back in place and funding it. What's your thoughts on Export-Import Bank? Is that, once again, just one more cog in the wheel of big government?
It's a very, very disgusting form of insider cronyism where a handful of big companies like Boeing and General Electric get subsidies from the American taxpayers. And a lot of these subsidies actually wind up getting transferred to people overseas. So, mm-hmm. you know, the people who buy the products from GE and Boeing and elsewhere. So it really is a nauseatingly corrupt example of insider government, and it's really, really depressing.
You know, I had to notice Boeing, biggest benefactor of the Export-Import Bank, of course, big contracts around the world. And I read an article the other day where they're taking a lot of corporate money and buying back their own stock. And to me, when a company buys back its own stock, that tells me it doesn't have anything better to do with its money. And it just seemed ironic that they're the biggest benefactor of the Export-Import. And obviously, they've got a lot of cash laying around that they need to do something with.
So. Well, you know, I don't care what a company does with its own money. I don't care if a company gets big, as long as they're operating honestly.
Right.
If they are selling products in a competitive free market with no favoritism from the government, heck, if they can earn 90% of the market, if they can earn huge profits, hey, none of it's based on coercion, more power to them. Mm-hmm. But when they're doing things like the Export-Import Bank, which is just like the sugar program, yep, less than 1% of the people benefit from it, and the rest of us pay, but those 1% get very organized, and they give a lot of cash to the corrupt politicians.
I want to switch gears on you a little bit in a couple of minutes we have left. Recently, Janet Yellen finally raised interest rates 25 basis points. Give us your quick thoughts on the Federal Reserve and monetary policy and interest rates. I'm one of these guys that wants the Federal Reserve to go away, even though I know it's not going to. But what's your thought on Yellen's monetary policy and interest rates?
Well, I suppose the good news is that I think Janet Yellen is actually better than Bernanke. She has taken this tiny small step to normalizing interest rates. In other words, not maintaining this artificially low interest rate policy, which I think was like trying to push on a string. It wasn't something that was was goosing the economy at all. Not that I think we should try to fine tune the economy anyhow. Right. But ultimately, in my fantasy world, and maybe yours based on what you said, wouldn't it be good if we just got the central bank out of the business of money and had a system of competitive currencies? And I've written about that on my blog as well.
Yeah, I think free market ought to apply to the currencies, to the interest rates, everything. Let the market reach equilibrium on its own. And there may be some bumps and grinds, but overall, I think we'd be a lot better off if government didn't try to manipulate things so much.
Well, we definitely did not have the very unstable boom-bust cycle before the Fed that we've had since the Fed.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But a 100-year institution, and you know, the founders of that or the creators are very smart in naming it the Federal Reserve, because then it sounds like a part of the federal government that we can't get rid of. So, it's interesting to watch the actions there.
Well, don't forget Ronald Reagan said the nearest thing to eternal life that we'll ever know is a government program.
That's absolutely right. We've been speaking with Dan Mitchell from the Cato Institute. He's a senior fellow over there specializing in fiscal policy, tax reform, international tax competition, and government spending. Dan, I really appreciate you spending some time with us today. It's been a while since we talked. I hope we don't go 16-18 months before we talk again. Once again, thank you so much for your time, and I hope we can tap you on the shoulder again soon.
All right, looking forward to it.
I appreciate it. Good work over at Cato.
Up next, a Christmas tradition that I can't live without. That's right, peanuts.
An Economy of One with Gary Rathbun. An Economy of One with Gary Rathbun.
You know, it's hard to believe it's been 50 years since a Charlie Brown Christmas was first aired. Either sadly or proudly, I've probably seen it every year for those 50 years. Started in 1965, and it was interesting because there was a producer that came to Charles M. Schulz, who represented one of his clients was Coca-Cola. And Coca-Cola wanted to put together a Christmas program that was animated to sponsor and air on TV. So Mendelsohn and the director, Bill Melendez, and Charles Schulz got together, put the show together in just a couple of months. And they made it very different, of course, for those of you that have seen it, and I'm sure everybody has seen it. But they took out the laugh track and put in a jazz score, okay, which has become very famous, especially the Linus and Looney, especially the Linus and Lucy theme song. And one of the big things of the Charlie Brown Christmas was Linus's explanation of Christmas, where he quoted Bible verses out of the Gospel of Luke. Now, the creative partners voiced a lot of concern to Schulz about that, who replied simply, "If we don't do it, who will?" When they produced, when they showed it to the executives at CBS, the execs hated it. They said the Bible thing scares us, which sounds like something that would be said today. But this was back in 1965. Fortunately, it was too late to change. Too late to change, so they had to air it. And more than 15 million viewers tuned in at the time. It won an Emmy for children's programming in 1966. And Coca-Cola, the main sponsor, read a lot of letters or got a lot of letters praising them for having the courage to sponsor not only an excellent product, but one that included some religious overtones. To this day, the show is still well-received. 7-8 million people watch it every year, and people look forward to it as part of the Christmas tradition. And it's fascinating to watch because the story is purposeful characters, simple, nothing fancy, no fancy computer algorithms. Pixar did not do this. No sexual overtones, no double entendre jokes, none of that. It is innocent and it's enjoyable. The problem is, not everybody feels that way. And there's a school in Kentucky. I'm sure you heard about this. Glenn Beck was talking about this. But they needed to take out, they decided to take out all religious references must be removed from the Christmas programs. Now, they put on a play called A Charlie Brown Christmas, where they essentially did the TV show, only they did it in a play form. Well, they were instructed to remove the scene where Linus shares the true meaning of Christmas by reading the Gospel of Luke. And the superintendent confirmed that. And the district had received, the reason they pulled it out was the district had received one complaint. So Glenn Beck got a hold of this, and it tells you the power of radio. He said, you know, if I was there and one of the parents, when the question was asked, what's the true meaning of Christmas, I, as a parent, would get all the other parents to stand up and read the verse and answer the question. Well, oddly enough, that's exactly what happened. When the play was being presented, and it came time for Linus to make his speech and was asked, what's the true meaning of Christmas? All these parents stood up and read the verse out loud. And, of course, it disrupted the play to some extent, and some self-righteous do-gooders were complaining, I wish they would have let the children finish the play. Okay, well, that's the end of the play anyway. I understand that. But I find it mildly satisfying. Now, those of you that listen to me, I don't take sides on the religious aspect of anything. That, to me, is up to each individual personally. I do take exception to censorship and to stifling of free speech, that kind of stuff in the name of political correctness, and one person gets a hair up their hind end, and it causes a whole school system to change their Christmas program, which is probably called simply a holiday program, not a Christmas program, but it should be a Christmas program. Then I have a problem. And this example, what happened here, I think, is a living proof of American exceptionalism. I read about this from an article written by Rick Moran on American Thinker. Rick Moran writes some great stuff. And it gave an opportunity for parents to not only right a wrong and stand up for free speech, but they did it in front of their kids. And that is huge, to have that simple act of defiance that one person tried to deny people of a heritage and the tradition of Christmas. None of these kids are going to grow up scarred because they read a Bible verse. You remember last week we talked about the, I think it was in Virginia, the school where the teacher was asking, telling the kids to write verses out of the Quran, and the uproar for that, and the backpedaling, and the apologizing, and the non-apologizing, and the defiance. I mean, it was silly. Absolutely silly. But there was clearly an underlying politically correct agenda with that versus a traditional Christmas play. And I think that's the distinction we need to make here, is Charlie Brown Christmas isn't out there to be anything other than what it is, just a simple story, and not be a indoctrination, a brainwashing, a politically correct acceptance level, or anything like that. It just is what it is. And it's part of our heritage. It's been around for 50 years. My goodness. Absolutely unbelievable that it's been that long. Charles Schulz has had a great, great influence on America over the years. I remember as one Christmas present, my mom got me a book called The Parables of Peanuts. And I still have the book. I haven't read it in a long time. But one thing I remember out of it that seemed to resonate with me, and I'll leave you with this thought, is that Charlie Brown was talking to Lucy at her psychiatric stand, and he said to her, "You know what your problem is? Your problem is you don't love mankind." And Lucy had the greatest line. It said, "I love mankind. It's people I can't stand." And I have remembered that since the time I was 10 years old. I think my mom got me that book. So I'm not really in that mode. I like people, but there are just days. So I hope you had a great Christmas. New Year's coming up. Be careful and enjoy the new year. Next week, we will talk about 2015 and my expectation of 2016. It's going to be a great year. Can't wait. I want you to have a great day. Be an individual. Be self-reliant. Be an economy of one. I'm Gary Rathbun. We'll see you next time.
This is our country.
The views expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect the views of this station. Listeners should consult their own financial advisors or conduct their own due diligence before making any financial decisions. Private Wealth Consultants is an SEC-registered investment advisor.